The Amos and Andy Show.
Amos and Andy's portrayal of black life and culture was deemed by the black community of the period to be an insulting return to the days of blackface and minstrelsy. Eventually, the controversy surrounding the television version almost equaled that of the popularity of the radio version. Talking History's James Madison, professor of history at Indiana University, talks about the controversy surrounding Amos and Andy with his guest, Melvin Patrick Ely.
The American fascination with early radio comedy continues. Few, if any, of the early radio shows are more fascinating than Amos and Andy. Yet this program, with white actors playing the roles of two black men, Amos and Andy, was always controversial, as it was popular, and remains so today. Our guest is Melvin Patrick Ely, professor of history and black studies at the College of William and Mary. Professor Ely is the author of a book titled The Adventure of Amos and Andy, A Social History of an American Phenomenon, a book that's just been published in the 10th anniversary edition with a new preface by the University of Virginia Press. Welcome, Melvin Ely.
Thanks very much.
Let's begin with just a description of these two characters, and they really were characters. Who was Amos? Who was Andy?
Amos and Andy were depicted as two black characters, young men, who were doing what tens of thousands of real African Americans were doing in the 20s when this radio show originated, namely moving out of the rural South to the big northern city to seek their fortunes. Amos was a meek, unassuming, high-voiced, moral, diligent fellow, and Andy was a low-voiced blowhard whose pretensions to urban sophistication constantly foundered on the shoals of his own ignorance. He was sort of the type who always had a scheme to get ahead and ended up failing and yet bossing Amos around. So they were kind of a complementary pair.
And listeners, I assume, would tend to laugh more at Andy than at Amos, or not?
Actually, the humor was pretty well distributed between the two of them. An interesting thing about Amos and Andy was that it didn't take the common pattern of straight line, punchline, straight line, punchline. So each of the characters got his licks in.
Mm-hmm. But Amos and Andy were played by two men who were not black.
That's right. That's right. The creators of Amos and Andy, and by the way, they played all the roles, the many roles in the series for the first 10 years or so by themselves, were Charles Correll of Peoria, Illinois, and Freeman Gosden of Richmond, Virginia, both of whom were born toward the end of the 19th century, and who had met when they were working as professional directors of blackface minstrel shows. So they had roots in a very old manner of depicting African Americans with white actors, and they made the transition from that tradition-bound genre into radio and created Amos and Andy.
Can you tell us a little bit more about blackface minstrel shows? What are those, and
well,
how do they relate?
The minstrel show actually was created in the big cities of the North before the Civil War. It's a combination of music, dance, and comedy in which white men would black their faces and purport to imitate the culture and the ways of African Americans. And it's a form that was in its heyday around the Civil War years, but actually survived well into the 20th century, at least on the amateur stage.
But how is this program, Amos and Andy, different from those kinds of 19th century minstrel shows? Is it the same thing, or is it different?
Well, in some ways it's similar, because the minstrel show, of course, being put on by whites in a race-conscious society, spent a good deal of its time making fun of blacks and caricaturing them. And there's certainly that element in Amos and Andy. There are, in fact, entire episodes that are sort of vaudeville or minstrel show type set pieces where Amos and Andy are struggling over trying to balance the books of their little business and demonstrating their complete incompetence in arithmetic or something of that sort. But Amos and Andy was also very different in that, besides being a comedy, it was a continuing story. It was broadcast daily for 15 minutes, and Gosden and Carell were masters at creating characters whom people in the audience could actually come to care about. They could build suspense. They could broadcast cliffhanger episodes to the point where I, when researching the book and reading the scripts, found myself eager often to find out what would happen to these characters the next day. So that's really what hooked America, the fact that there's the sort of comfortable minstrel-style comedy that white people were used to, but there's also this this human element that grabs the even the emotions and tugs at the heartstrings at times.
Can you give us an example of that human element, that universal quality that you find in the Amos and Andy shows?
One example would be a series of episodes in which Ruby Taylor, who's the fiance of Amos, becomes sick. And at the beginning of the week, there's some mention that she has the sniffles. And by the middle of the week, it's a cold. And by Thursday, it's pneumonia. And on Friday evening, she's in the hospital. And at the end of the episode, the listener is given the impression that maybe she has just died. And then the listener has to wait through a day's hiatus and tune in again 2 days later to find out, is Ruby dead or is she alive? And the amount of fan mail that something like that would demonstrate and the emotional investment people made in whether Ruby lived or Ruby died is exactly what I'm talking about when I speak of the empathy that these shows could evoke.
So you're suggesting that white listeners became intimately connected to this character who was clearly an African-American woman, Ruby.
Yes, and it may be that this could only have happened in radio. I read this morning where the new managing editor of Rolling Stone magazine said that all the great media adventures of the 20th century have been visual, which completely ignores the fact that the two dominant media of the mid-century were movies and radio. And in radio, the visual dimension is there, but it's entirely in the mind of each individual listener. So the race of the characters is certainly there, and it's unmistakable because of the caricatured dialect. And yet each person, and yet the race is not thrown in your face the way it would be on a television screen later. The listener, I think, found it easier to empathize precisely because he or she could create images of these characters in his or her own mind.
Mm-hmm. Can you say more about radio and radio in the 20s and 30s, the late 20s and 30s, when Amos and Andy was so popular? More about listeners and the nature of the shows and of comedy shows like this and what appealed to people?
Well, radio in the 20s, and that's the decade in which commercial radio emerged, really, until Amos and Andy, basically consisted of broadcasts of performances that you could see in a theater or vaudeville house or something of the sort. Radio hadn't done anything new except to transmit the stuff electronically. Amos and Andy is the show that made radio a medium in its own right. The sale of radios skyrocketed because of Amos and Andy, because they did something that the vaudeville stage couldn't do and that the movies couldn't do, and that is to tell this continuing story day after day after day for months and months at a time. And the response was overwhelming. The Amos and Andy series in the early years had a listenership of about 40 million. This in a country that had a population of only 125 million at the time. Restaurants, hotel lobbies, movie theaters would pipe in the nightly broadcast for 15 minutes because they would lose their clientele otherwise. Factory shifts, shift changes were rescheduled. And you could literally walk down the street of an American city on a summer evening when everyone's windows would be open, and not miss a word of Amos and Andy, because almost every radio would be tuned to it. So there's a way in which radio made Amos and Andy, but even more so, I think Amos and Andy made radio as a medium.
Yes. And this was a 15-minute show every weeknight?
Six nights a week.
Six
usually,
nights a
yes.
week. Yeah. Was it live or recorded?
It was live. It was in the very first days, they Gosden and Carell also recorded their shows actually on discs and distributed them around the country that way. But by the time the show came onto the network in 1929, it was live. You bet. It didn't matter where in the country they were; they would broadcast that show by remote feed over NBC.
Mm-hmm. Well, as popular as it was, it was also controversial. And you write in your book, The Adventures of Amos and Andy, about an early controversy in 1931. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. The Amos and Andy show had a huge following among both African Americans and whites. But there was also black protest almost from the beginning. What happened in 31 was that the editor of the Pittsburgh Courier, which was one of the two most popular African-American weekly newspapers, mounted a petition campaign among blacks demanding that the show be taken off the air on the grounds that white actors were exploiting black stereotypes and that in doing this, they were holding back the progress of the black race by depicting African-Americans as incompetence. And during the course of 1931, Robert Vann, that newspaper editor, claimed, and I think probably plausibly, to have collected something like 750,000 black signatures demanding that Amos and Andy be removed. This at the same time that tens of thousands of other African Americans were listening to the show and delighting in it. I mean, we have vivid vignettes of scenes in Harlem where African Americans who were too poor to have radios would gather at barbershops or outside radio stores, even on the sidewalk, to listen to this show, partly because Gosden and Carell actually lifted their style and some of their material even from the most popular black acts of the time, especially Miller and Lyles, a famous comedy team. And a lot of black folk tuned in this show for months before they found out that these were even white actors. Mm.
So you're suggesting then that this controversy in 1931 leads to a conclusion that there is no such thing as the black voice, or I guess in this case the black ear, in terms of listening to Amos and Andy. Can you distinguish that a little bit? Why would some African Americans be so strongly opposed to this program while others would be so supportive of it and eager to hear it?
Those who were eager to hear it, I think, were so for a couple of reasons. One is they found the show, surprising to us in 2002, authentic. It sounded so much like certain genuine styles of African-American humor that were prevalent at the time that it was just natural to tune into this show and laugh along with it. Another reason that many blacks felt free to enjoy the show, especially African-Americans in the middle class, was that they felt that Amos and Andy was depicting a type of black American other than themselves. There are many letters and other evidence that we have in which middle-class black folk, especially in the North, write, I've known a lot of black folk in the South who were just like Amos and Andy, and aren't they quaint and aren't they funny? And therefore, to laugh at them was not to laugh at oneself, or even to admit that the middle class is being depicted here at all. Now, on the other hand, you have black Americans who conclude that white America listens to this show and makes up its mind that all blacks are as depicted here. And if you think that, then you're going to want this thing taken off the air pronto.
Right. Let's move forward from this debate over the show in 1931, when it's a radio show, to 1950, 51, when it becomes a TV show. And again, the controversy flares up at this point.
Yes, and that's a little bit ironic, because when the CBS network decided to make the transition of Amos and Andy to television, they actually tried to, as they say, clean up the show a little bit. They tried to eliminate some of the more blatant stereotypes, understanding that the country really had changed between 1928 and 1951. The experience of the radio show itself proves this. You will find depictions in white newspapers of events, personal appearances by the Amos and Andy duo in the early 30s, in which a white reporter writing for white readers will emphasize how Amos and Andy never make fun of the black race. And I try to figure out why, in 1931, when the United States couldn't even pass a federal anti-lynching bill, any white person would think that other whites cared what black folks think. And what I see happening is that little by little, many whites are getting to the point where they're going to tune in Amos and Andy anyhow, but they can feel just a little bit better about it if they think that blacks aren't offended. And this is the sentiment that CBS was trying to tap into in 51. What they didn't realize was, when you clean up the set, you create a visual image. You have an apartment where the central character by 51, the Kingfish, lives, and it's a middle-class apartment. Amos, Andy, and the Kingfish are dressed in middle-class clothes, but they're still speaking the same dialect and getting into the same situations, that you're delivering the message, potentially, that you can, no matter how much you clean up these characters, and no matter how much you urbanize the black American, he's still going to be like Amos and Andy in 1928. Mm-hmm. The NAACP looks at this. Walter White, the head of the NAACP, had been fighting stereotypes in Hollywood movies for a dozen years. He's thinking, here comes television, a new medium. It's a new page in media history where blacks will be portrayed in a progressive way. Along comes the first program to depict an all-black cast, and it's one that harks back to 1928. Right. So the NAACP protests vociferously.
Right. We have time for just another question, Mel. Is there still fear of talking about Amos and Andy today, of talking about it honestly?
I'll tell you, I think there's a lot less fear than there was when I first published this book. The reception of the book is proof of that, in that an awful lot of white and black commentators seem to welcome the chance to talk about Amos and Andy and look back and see what it had all meant. And yet, even today, there is fear, mostly among certain white Americans. There are black Americans who have bitter memories of Amos and Andy and would rather it not be brought up. But among whites, give you an example. There was a movie producer not long ago who was looking at the possibility of making a docudrama about the Amos and Andy experience. He canvassed about half a dozen writers, potential script writers, four or five of whom loved the idea, and one whose name every listener would recognize said, "Oh my God, I couldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. I'd get in all sorts of trouble." Mm-hmm. So there are still mainly white folks today who are afraid to touch the subject.
Right, right. Well, thank you, Mr. Ely. We've been talking today with Melvin Ely, the author of The Adventure of Amos and Andy, A Social History of an American Phenomenon.
Then he gets their body pounded, goes to a beauty shop and gets the fat beat off of them. Oh, I tell you, they is getting slap happy around that age.
Yes, I know. Mud packs and everything.
Yeah, don't tell me about mud packs. I remember one night, in the dark, I goes to kiss my wife with a heart full of love.